WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. UVA cancer researchers discover a potential new treatment for the deadliest form of brain cancer. Governor Spanberger ends agreements between state law enforcement agencies and ICE. And a new partnership between the Wildlife Center of Virginia and Bridgewater College gives turtles a place to stay for the winter and students an opportunity to learn rehabilitation. This is the WMRA Daily for Thursday, February 5th. Cancer researchers at the University of Virginia say they have found a potential new treatment for the deadliest form of brain cancer. Scientists at UVA's Comprehensive Cancer Center identified a molecule that blocks the gene responsible for glioblastoma, which strikes 14,000 Americans every year and has no cure. The discovery raises hopes that the molecule could contribute to a much-needed new treatment to fight the cancer, but more research is needed. The findings are published in the journal Science Translational Medicine. A Virginia House of Delegates subcommittee postponed voting on a controversial bill that would dissolve the governing board at Virginia Military Institute. The Daily Progress reports that the Subcommittee for Higher Education voted to pass by the bill for the day. That's a mechanism used when a body is not ready to take action. The full committee can still take up the bill, but if it does not cast a vote before the deadline, the bill will die. The bill would transfer control of the school to Virginia State University. VMI's culture and leadership have been a political football since 2021, when an investigation determined the school tolerated racism and sexism. Opponents described the bill as retribution by Democrats and logistically problematic. A separate bill under consideration would remove VMI's state funding. Governor Abigail Spanberger is ending agreements between state law enforcement agencies and Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Virginia Public Radio's Brad Kuttner reports.
Governor Abigail Spanberger gave herself the authority to pull out of agreements with ICE on her first day in office, but Wednesday, she decided to use it.
Taking Virginia law enforcement state agency personnel and basically giving them over to ICE is something that ends today.
The move comes after the deaths of two U.S. citizens at the hands of federal agents shocked the nation, and attempts to open immigration detention centers in Virginia saw bipartisan pushback. Among those who praised Spanberger for the move was immigration advocate Luis Aguilar with the group CASA.
We are at CASA. We're incredibly happy that she has listened to the communities and that she has terminated disagreements. And we look forward to working even more closely with the governor as she protects immigrants and all Virginians.
The move is likely to draw the ire of conservatives. Bob Holsworth is a longtime political analyst in Richmond. He pointed to the lengthy airtime conservative media outlets have already directed at Spanberger and argued this would be added to the list of complaints.
Republicans are going to try to use this nationally to suggest once again, as they have been doing for the last few weeks on Fox, that she's really not a monarch.
Spanberger also signed an executive order outlining guiding principles for state law enforcement agencies. The EO says, among points, that, quote, public trust is a prerequisite to effective policing. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Meanwhile, Democratic lawmakers are trying to stop immigration enforcement inside Virginia's courthouses. The Virginia Senate passed a bill on Tuesday that would prevent ICE from arresting people who have been called to a court hearing. The law also prohibits immigration officers from entering a courthouse to make an arrest unless they meet certain requirements. A court challenge to Democrats' efforts to draw new congressional districts has made its way to the state's highest court. Virginia's Court of Appeals asked the Supreme Court of Virginia to hear the case. Jad Khalil with VPM News reports.
Last week, a judge in Tazewell County said the Democrats didn't follow the law when drafting a constitutional amendment needed to redraw Virginia's political maps. It was the first of two apparent setbacks for General Assembly Democrats. Democrats appealed the ruling, and Wednesday, the Virginia Court of Appeals made the request to the Supreme Court of Virginia. In the filing, the court wrote that the appeal was, quote, of such imperative public importance that it required a prompt decision from the High Court. Tuesday, Virginia's Attorney General Jay Jones made a motion to intervene in the case. Jones is a Democrat. The other setback is that Democrats haven't finalized maps, which they had intended to release last month. It appears that the House of Delegates and State Senate are in disagreement over how districts should be drawn. It's not immediately clear when the Supreme Court could hear the case, but a proposed referendum date of April 21st is quickly approaching.
Jad Khalil reporting. The General Assembly is considering a plan to create a new regulated marketplace for marijuana. But Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports that advocates are unhappy with potential new penalties.
What happens if someone under the age of 18 is in possession of marijuana? Or what happens if someone tries to sell marijuana without a license? And what kind of punishment should someone face for having more than 5 pounds? J.M. Padini, Virginia Normal, says a Senate panel is answering those questions by recriminalizing marijuana.
We just watched Democrats vote yes for new marijuana mandatory minimums.
Valerie Slater at Rise for Youth says she's concerned about criminalizing kids.
We want to ensure that whatever it is that we come out with is a bill that does not add criminal penalty to children. We cannot allow that to move forward.
Chelsea Higgs-Wise at Marijuana Justice says she hopes the Senate Finance Committee will strip out all the new penalties that were added by the Senate Courts of Justice Committee.
In 2024, we saw the same approach to adding mandatory minimums from Chairman Surville, and we saw what happened in Senate Finance was they were completely removed by the chairwoman, Senator Lucas. So we are hoping for that same type of action.
Senators will still have to negotiate with the House and ultimately Governor Spanberger about how the retail marketplace will work and what kind of penalties violators will face.
As we've been reporting, the General Assembly is considering an effort to remove some of the last Confederate statues in Richmond. And Michael has more on that story.
Richmond's Monument Avenue has zero Confederate statues, but Capitol Square still has three, and they're in a very prominent spot right in front of the Capitol. That's always bothered former Delegate Bob Brink.
The more recent statues that have been erected there, the Women's Monument, the Civil Rights Monument, the Native American, Native Virginians Monument, those speak to the best of us. And the statues of Hunter McGuire, Extra Billy Smith, and Stonewall Jackson speak to the worst of us.
That's why he's been pressing Senator Adam Eben to introduce a bill to get rid of the statues as one of his last efforts in the General Assembly before he joins the Spanberger administration.
They say you should leave a campsite better than you found it. And to me, I'd like to leave Capitol Square a little bit better than I found it 22 years ago.
Eben also has a bill to ditch the racist state song emeritus, Carry Me Back to Old Virginia.
The Civil War ended 160 years ago, and or 588,740 days ago. It's time to get over it.
Eben's bill to get rid of the statues was approved by the Senate Finance Committee on a party line vote. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
An effort to limit the collection of images of your face and eyes, sometimes called biometric data, without consent, failed to get out of a House of Delegates committee on Wednesday. Brad Kuttner has this report.
According to Prince William County Delegate Michelle Maldonado, the security camera you've installed on your door is collecting not only your face, but the faces of those who visit you.
So if I am a neighbor that comes next door and I need a cup of sugar because I'm making my sugar cookies, and I knock on your door, ring your doorbell, they could take my biometric data, and I don't even know.
Maldonado's bill wouldn't limit the use of these cameras, but it would require consent for that image to be collected. She said states like Texas and Illinois have similar data collection limits, and she pointed to recent reports that some grocery stores were collecting such data.
And I, and many people who have asked me to bring this bill and things like this, don't want to live in a world that looks like Minority Report.
As in the 2002 sci-fi classic. And while Maldonado's bill had support from progressive groups, the grocery store industry had other concerns. Here's Travis Smiley with Virginia Food Industry Association.
This is a way to help be able to identify wrongdoers in order to protect both the community as well as our associates and the products that we sell.
The bill was laid on the table, killed for the year, with members of both parties voting for and against. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Governor Abigail Spanberger recently named Melissa Smith as the head of the Virginia Employment Commission. Smith has held senior leadership roles at the White House and with the U.S. Labor and Commerce Department. The VEC administers Virginia's unemployment insurance program. Smith said she looked forward to, quote, strengthening programs that support Virginians during times of job loss and transition. Some turtle patients from the Wildlife Center of Virginia in Waynesboro are spending the winter at Bridgewater College, giving the students hands-on experience with rehabilitation. WMRA's Randy B. Hagee has the story.
Inside the McKinney Center for Science and Mathematics at Bridgewater College on a recent Friday morning, six woodland box turtles slowly scraped around plastic tubs with shallow baths of water.
Currently, we have them set up for their soak, so they get about 3 hours of time to just kind of sit in water. They get this little mat, so that way they have like a surface to grip on.
Chase Carter is a sophomore studying environmental science with a minor in wildlife biology. She's taking a practicum course on wildlife rehabilitation this semester, part of the college's partnership with the Wildlife Center of Virginia. Center co-founder Ed Clark and Senior Vice President Amanda Nicholson are both Bridgewater alumni, and the two institutions have collaborated on research for years. The college was recently permitted with the Virginia Department of Wildlife Resources as a satellite rehabilitation facility for the Wildlife Center. Carter puts on nitrile gloves and picks up one of the turtles. It's a bit bigger than one hand, with a yellow and brown dappled shell and red eyes. It speaks to us quietly. She walks me through the body condition checks they conduct to monitor the turtle's health.
We try to get the head out, and luckily this guy likes to stick his head out, but we kind of grab back here. We want to put our fingers back here because, as you can see, they like to tuck in. They're very strong. You want to pull their head out. When we do that, we will feel the top of their head just to feel that bump, and we do it very gently as well.
So how does his feel?
So he feels like he's got, you can visually see that he's kind of got that, like, bump over top, and when you feel it, it's strong. So okay. I would rate him like a 3, which for us, that means that he's not underweight, he's not overweight, he's a healthy turtle.
The program launched in the fall with a seminar in which Wildlife Center staff gave lectures on rehabilitation once a week.
It might be about, you know, physical exams, euthanasia, turtle husbandry.
Dr. Cara Pierce is the Wildlife Center's veterinary director. She said some of the Bridgewater turtles came to the center as confiscated illegal pets, others with injuries.
One of them actually had an oral abscess, so basically an ear infection that was treated at the Wildlife Center. That's now healed, but it's winter, so the turtle can't go back. When spring comes, he'll be released back to the wild.
He can't go directly from treatment into the winter weather because box turtles in the wild are currently in a state of dormancy called brumation.
They kind of just hunker down in one spot and ride out the winter. Usually it's going to be under like some loose soil, leaf litter, mud, a place where temperatures stay more stable, right? They just want to kind of maintain a stable temperature. They might like dig down a little bit to where the ground isn't going to freeze quite as much.
Having these medically stable turtles spend the winter at Bridgewater frees up space at the Wildlife Center for patients in need. As for the college students,
wildlife rehabilitation has really become much more specialized, and there are really few formal academic pathways for people to receive training in this or to receive training in working with wildlife in general. So this partnership is really going to help fill that gap between classroom learning and then real-world hands-on wildlife care.
Bridgewater College professor Tamara Johnston Yellen said most of the students in this program are environmental science or biology majors looking to work with wildlife.
Many of them have the wildlife minor as well, and some of them are pre-vet or just interested in animals. And the main point of this program is to get them hands-on experience that they may not otherwise get. So as a pre-veterinary student, you have to have a certain number of clinic hours handling animals, and so this allows them to do that, but in a wildlife context, which is very different than a domestic animal context.
That includes growing and preparing the turtle's food.
So this is the slurry that we make, and it is based mostly green leafy vegetables like kale, which we grow here, and we make up big batches and stick them in the freezer so that we can just pull as needed. But it's made of the green leafies that we grow here. This is what it's called a primate biscuit, which is a complete diet. And so we mush that up and add that. Some apples, some carrots, some broccoli, sometimes an orange. And then the topper, sometimes it's tomatoes. Today is a tomato day. Sometimes it's a meat-based protein. And then we also have our colonies of invertebrates, our superworms, and our mealworms.
They also clean and disinfect the turtles' separate habitats, each boasting leaves, wood chips, dirt, hidey holes, a wet rag, a small water pool, and a sun rock under a heat lamp. Emma Pultz, a senior biology major, is interning at the Wildlife Center in addition to taking this course.
When I first took the class, I didn't really know what I was doing and like what I wanted to do after college. But like since then, I've become really interested in rehabilitating wildlife or becoming a wildlife vet tech.
The goal is for the Bridgewater program to expand to other species in the future, permits depending. The next group of patients may be aquatic turtles. For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Hagee.
You can see photos of the turtles at WMRA.org and on our app. Full disclosure, Bridgewater College underwrites programming on WMRA. Rural Nelson County is home to plenty of wildlife, but the sheriff's office was not prepared for a recent call about one injured animal. Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Hausman has that story.
Lieutenant Stephen Bodick has been a law enforcement officer for more than 20 years, but he's never had a call like the one he got Saturday. Residents near the town of Arrington reported seeing an injured kangaroo. Bodick and another officer converged on the scene and spotted the suspect, but catching her was no easy job.
As soon as we exited the vehicle, it took off running, and it cleared 150 yards in about 3 seconds. I couldn't even get a picture of it.
The animal had a wounded leg, and Bodick tracked a trail of blood to a nearby property, where he informed the homeowner.
Knocked on the door, told the residents, hey, the police are here, we're chasing a kangaroo. Of course, she laughed at me. She put her dogs inside, and when I walked around back, it was there.
He phoned the local Wildlife Conservation Center, and the owner said he'd be right over with a tranquilizer gun. Then the sheriff's office got a call from another resident reporting another kangaroo. It turned out the first animal was a mother who'd been carrying a baby.
And their natural instinct, if they're chased from predators, is to hide the baby and lead the predators off. That's what we're assuming she did.
The Joey was located and returned to the Wildlife Center, and its mother was sedated enough that Bodek was able to pet her.
Surprisingly how soft they were. They're like a bunny rabbit.
Today, mother and baby are back home and making a good recovery from their weekend adventure. The police, meanwhile, are still talking about it. I'm Sandy Hausman.
Finally today, the Trump administration spent its first year remaking federal policy, including funding for programs to help unsheltered people. Also with Virginia Public Radio, Mason Adams reports on what that means for Virginia.
The charitable and nonprofit organizations that serve the homeless population use a variety of programs and techniques to aid people without housing. And they say they're bracing for major cuts to a program for the most chronically homeless individuals. It's called Permanent Supportive Housing, also known as Housing First. It takes individuals who meet the definition of chronic homelessness, many with disabilities, substance use disorder, and untreated mental illness, and places them in stable, subsidized housing before beginning the process of moving them into treatment programs and other services.
And we're talking about folks that were formerly chronically homeless, right? People living unsheltered on the street, the folks that nobody wants to see living outside. Nobody wants to see people living under overpasses or in the woods. It's immoral and it's inhumane.
Brian Koziol is the executive director of the Virginia Housing Alliance. He says Housing First works. It keeps people stable and in a location where service providers can find and help them.
It is the most cost-effective intervention that we have come up with to date. And when you get people into housing that provide supportive services, all of a sudden you reduce emergency room visits, you reduce police calls, you reduce reliance on other social services and programs.
Jay Brown is CEO of Commonwealth Catholic Charities. He says permanent supportive housing is more than 90% effective at keeping people housed, as borne out by multiple studies. But the program is threatened by major funding cuts. the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development floated a policy shift under President Trump that could push an estimated 3,200 people across Virginia out of permanent supportive housing.
The challenge is when you reduce the amount of resources that are available to help people exit homelessness, what you wind up having is people who stay homeless for longer.
Advocates are pushing back with legal action, and organizations are still sorting out what happens next. Commonwealth Catholic Charities operates Housing First programs in Richmond, Hopewell, and Roanoke. In Roanoke, the program has 42 slots, and the HUD policy change could slash 21 of those.
The biggest challenge for us is how do we make sure that we don't see a massive surge in homelessness again because people who have been housed through these permanent housing interventions become homeless again, and then the intervention that becomes available is just not designed to serve people who really need the help the most.
Brown says that should the policy change go forward, the nonprofit will try to replace those permanent housing slots with transitional housing. But it's not a one-to-one replacement, as individuals who now benefit from Housing First aren't necessarily eligible for the replacement. Other service providers are bracing for the blow, too. Matt Cruikshank is Roanoke's Human Services Coordinator and oversees the city's homeless assistance team.
It's vital. Not only were those 21 people that'll be without housing, it'll reduce the capacity of our community to provide that service. So that's less housing we can provide to that real high-need population. So it's a critical loss.
Brian Koziel with the Virginia Housing Alliance says it's taken decades to orient homeless assistance programs around Housing First and the results it delivers. Dismantling the program would be a major setback.
And once you lose that infrastructure, the work to rebuild that infrastructure is monumental, right? So it is really incumbent upon us all to do what we can to ensure that safety net infrastructure is still viable.
Commonwealth Catholic Charities and other service providers are still evaluating their options and figuring out what comes next. In Roanoke, I'm Mason Adams.
For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicki. I really appreciate you listening, and I hope you enjoy your Thursday.